Chapter 5. Sorrows Multiplied. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Oh, bring thou me out of my distresses. Look upon mine affliction and my pain, and forgive all my sins. Psalm of David. 1850. The move into the new house in town was a sad one indeed for Mary and her father. The house was not a home without Abigail, and the hired girl could not begin to replace Mahala Sanborn, who had married and was moving to North Groton, 40 miles away. All Mary had left in this world was 5-year-old Georgie, and he was a sore trial to his grandfather. She wrote despairingly to her brother a few months later. Last year, a little later than this, I went into that cold, damp house with Father, helped cleanse and set it in order, and lived alone with a little girl and him all winter. In the spring, he told me, if George was not sent away, he would send him to the poorhouse, after abusing him as he did through the winter. Mark's remarks were not from financial necessity, but from frustration, for his life was not easy at this juncture. He bore the responsibility for Mary and her son, but George was a difficult, boisterous youngster, and Abigail's gentle persuasion was no longer present. In October of 1850, word came from the West, where Martha's husband had gone for greater fortune, that he, Luther Pillsbury, had died very suddenly on a Mississippi River steamboat. Now the grief-stricken Martha and her two daughters, Ellen and Mary, were added to the household. It was another bittersweet reunion, but this arrangement did not continue for long. Of the adults in this gloomy, solemn band, only Mark was happy at Thanksgiving of 1850, for he was to marry Mrs. Elizabeth Patterson Duncan of Candia, New Hampshire, on the 5th of December. Mrs. Duncan was a genial, well-to-do widow from a prominent family, and it was a happy union for all concerned, save Mary. No one could replace her loved mother, and, at first, the marriage seemed a sacrilege to her. Martha and her daughters went to stay with her husband's family, and Abigail opened her spacious home to Mary. But no one wanted little George. That is, no one but Mahala Sanborn Cheney. Either the family could not tolerate George's boisterousness, or they felt that his presence was detrimental to Mary's delicate health. It was probably for both reasons that George was not welcome in Aunt Abigail's house, nor in that of his grandfather Baker next door. It is also probable that Abigail and her father arranged, without Mary's knowledge, to pay Mahala and her husband for George's board before convincing Mary that he should go to North Groton to live with them. What a blow that was! Mary had no home for herself and son, and neither the means nor the health to provide one. She had no alternative but to yield to the plan. George was sent to visit his uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Andrew J. Glover, in Concord, while the Cheneys were getting settled in their new home and only a very little of the anguish Mary felt in her heart crept into her letter to her brother-in-law and his wife. Sanborton Bridge, April 22. My dear bro and sis, Mrs. Cheney came here last Thursday and will return next week on Saturday. You can send my dear child when you please, the latter part of the week, as she is very anxious to have him when she goes home. She is very fond of children, and Georgie in particular, but her health is very poor. This I regret. She told me their school, which is about 1/4 of a mile distant, will commence in a few weeks, and I am anxious to have him attend. But oh, how I miss him already. There seems nothing left me now to enjoy. I often stand by my window when the shades of evening close o'er me and gaze on yonder sacred spot where sleeps my peaceful mother and invoke her blessing and counsel while I almost envy her repose. But I must not write on this subject, for words are impotent things to utter the feelings of a mother's heart. Won't you send me a line by him, or come yourselves? I want very much to know how you have succeeded with him, and if he has been a good boy. Some naughty things, of course. There is no child whom we expect mature in every respect. But take Georgie with the aggregate. Is he not a pretty good and very dear boy? You can speak to the conductor to take care of him and his little baggage, and Mr. Tilton is always at the depot, so he will see to him there. Will dear little Sully be sorry to have him leave? How is Foth and Moth's health? Give much love to them from me, and accept the same yourselves. Kiss the little one for me, and tell him Auntie remembers those roguish eyes. In much haste, yours affectionately, Mary. Mary often kept her mental meeting at twilight with her mother, the one person in the world with whom she had had spiritual rapport. The words her mother had penned a few years earlier applied to Mary now, i.e., quote, "Your memory is dearer to me than gold. Language cannot express my feelings. My sight is almost failed with weeping." End quote. How she longed for her mother's counsel in this present trial. She knelt by George's bedside and prayed for relief the long night before he was sent away. The next day after he was gone, she wrote, "Mother's darling," in her journal, written on the 9th day of May, on parting with my babe. Go, little voyager, o'er life's rough sea, born in a tempest, choose thy pilot, God. The Bible, let thy chart forever be. Anchor and helm its promises afford. Could monarch's diadem, or lordly crown, or oriental treasures purchase thee? Ah, 'twere a mockery, 'twere a paltry sum, coined for so bright a gem as little G. A father's love, my heart, be still or break, not to thy infant hours in joy made known, and thou mayest live to learn thy hapless fate, reft of thy parent stock, frail, sick, and lone. Then wilt thou share thy mother's voiceless woe, too keen for utterance, too deep for tears, Yet God forbid thy guileless heart should know the early blight of unprotected years. Thy smile through tears, as sunshine o'er the sea, awoke new beauty in the surge's roll. All life is dead, bereft of all with thee, star of my earthly hope, babe of my soul. Mary's grief was truly too keen for utterance, too deep for tears. With George gone, she had nothing to live for. Little wonder that her physical problems intensified, and she suffered a serious relapse. The physical agony she endured, confined often to her bed, reflected the anguish in her heart. Her loving family saw not the connection between her loss and her suffering, and felt they had done the right thing in sending her child away. It seemed that Mary could not recover. Everyone, including her father, stepmother, and the doctor, did all they could for her, but the burden fell heaviest on Abigail. By midsummer, Martha had come to help both her sisters, as recorded in her letter of August 10th, to her brother and his wife, George and Martha. "I am quite worn out and sick, and have come up to Father's to try rest with a little medicine. But have we not the assurance, and can I ever doubt it, that as thy day so shall thy strength be? May mine continue, that I may contribute to dear Mary's comfort, while she may live, if she cannot recover, and afford Abby the assistance she so much needs." Martha bought a house for herself and children to make the move to Sanborton Bridge permanent, but much of her time was spent nursing Mary. The weeks dragged into months, and the new year saw no improvement in Mary's condition. Martha wrote despairingly to Martha Rand Baker, George's wife, on the 4th of January in 1852. "Found her very sick from one of her most severe attacks of dyspepsia, liver complaint, and nervous disease. It would be impossible to point out the changes or trace the progress of disease down to the present time, or describe the hopes and fears, doubts and expectations that have affected us respecting the result during this long period of continued suffering, having been all the time confined to the room and bed, except when possibly able to be helped into a carriage to ride. And what can I say of her now? How tell you that after so long and inconceivable suffering, though still living and perhaps doomed to yet longer and greater affliction by an all-wise but inscrutable providence, yet there is scarcely a ray of hope left us of her recovery. Her strength gradually fails, and all the powers of life seem yielding to the force of disease. Oh, Martha, it would move the sternest soul and make mortality shrink to witness the agony she often endures." But from this seemingly hopeless condition, Mary did recover, and in time she was enjoying working in the garden, visiting her father and stepmother next door, or their dear friends, the Clements, across the street. The Clements were as literary as the Bakers and Tiltons, so they enjoyed the exchange of both books and conversation. Mary kept her anguish in her heart and for her hours of solitude. To her friends and relatives, she was the same cheerful, sweet, witty Mary of gentle disposition. Sarah Clement, who had attended Mrs. Glover's infant school the years it continued, was now 11 years old and a constant visitor in the house across the street. In later years, she was angered by the press's malicious attacks on Mrs. Eddy and refuted their false claims of this period in her reminiscences. I saw her daily in those years of my childhood. The Tilton house was directly across the street from our house, and Mrs. Eddy was a frequent visitor while I ran over to her house any time of the day, hanging about as children will, sometimes unobserved, but always observing. Mrs. Eddy was never too absorbed in what she was doing to be gracious and interested in my childish conversation. Tall, slender, and exceedingly graceful, she was altogether one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen. My uncle said that as a boy, he used to sit in church without thinking of the service, his thoughts being busy contemplating Mrs. Glover's beauty. She was always neatly but simply dressed. Mrs. Tilton was inclined to be the dressy member of the family. Mrs. Eddy had a happy disposition. She was always cheerful. I never saw her when she was the least depressed, and I have seen her at all times and on all occasions. She read a great deal and used to borrow books from our library. Her laugh was very sweet, and I often used to hear her talking to my mother and laughing. She had a nice sense of humor. I was quite a pet of Mrs. Eddy's, and sometimes when I went over, she would read to me. I remember her reading Longfellow's Hyperion, a little German tale, especially. Toward night, I would see her working in the garden. She always wore gloves with the fingertips cut off. I used to run across the road and hang over the gate and discuss things. People often ask me if she was an educated woman. She and her whole family were refined and very bright, intellectual people of their day. Mrs. Eddy herself was better educated at that time, despite its limited opportunities, than half the girls nowadays. Not many girls of today can translate the Iliad, and she did. Mrs. Tilton was also a handsome woman, but extremely determined and very fiery when angry. Mrs. Tilton was a leader in everything. It is probable that Mrs. Glover first met Dr. Daniel Patterson socially as he was related to her stepmother. But by the end of 1852, she was consulting him professionally for the care of her teeth. He was a fine, progressive dentist who evidently extracted some of Mary's teeth, for she wrote him on the 12th of December. "I would like to retain as long as possible all I have left. Feeling the chagrin of my present mouth, most essentially. Never knowing before the loss of teeth, I was ignorant of all the difficulties I find attendant." Daniel Patterson was attracted to the beautiful young widow from the first, but the attraction was not altogether one-sided, Daniel was tall, handsome, well-dressed, and very genial. He had attained a degree of competence and success in dentistry, frequently traveling through rural areas to practice his profession. And he had recently located more permanently by opening an office in Franklin, 3 miles from Sandborton Bridge. When he proposed marriage in March of 1853, Mary's objection was on religious grounds. She wrote him after a sleepless night, "I have a fixed feeling that to yield my religion to yours, I could not. Other things compared to this are but a grain to the universe." Daniel was persistent, but Mary's family objected to the union. Mark, it seems, had heard dark things about this itinerant dentist. So a second time, Mary said no. In response, Daniel wrote, "Franklin, Monday morn, April 11th, 1853. Dear Mary, it seems that I have lost you at last, that you have made your final decision against me and refuse to see me again, and there is nothing left for me to do but submit to your decree. I thought I would at first vindicate my moral character and prepared a letter for your father's perusal, but on more mature deliberation and knowing that you had become dissatisfied with my disposition and wished, yes, had already irrevocably dismissed me, I concluded to withhold all I had written." With this farewell letter, Daniel included a touching poem. "Like a linkless chain enthralling, like the sleepless dreams that mock, like the frigid ice drops falling from the surf-surrounded rock, such the drear and sickening feeling that has caused this heart to know, stabbed me deeper by concealing from the world its humbling woe. Once it fondly, fondly called thee, all that fancy deemed divine. Then it honored and esteemed thee as an idol and a shrine. Yet, when my lone life is over, should thine own be lengthened long, thou mayest then alone discover by thy feelings all my own." The first two stanzas applied more to Mary's past experiences than to Daniel's present state. But his persistence was affecting Mary's resistance. Marriage to him held out the promise of a home for herself and George. The letter he had withheld temporarily, may have softened her father's attitude. Franklin, April 10th, 1853. Mary M. Glover. "Much to my surprise, I learn that your family object to our union on grounds new and strange to me. You say they have heard dark things. Of what they are, I am ignorant. But of the source, I am not ignorant. They must have been probing, not a heavenly angel, blessed Bethesda, the sure panacea of all the sufferings of humanity, but some low cesspool of foul, slanderous suspicion, down which Lucifer plunged his hydra head and dividing hoof. I will take your father to all the places where I have made a stand, and he may make inquiries in relation to my conduct of any reliable persons. I will take him to my native town and introduce him to clergymen and businessmen of character and standing in society who have long known and dealt with me, some of the members of the Congregational Church, who are in no way connected by blood or interest with me, but who have known me from infancy. I should like to take him up to Hill and introduce him to Esquire Sumner, in whose family I have boarded most of the time spent in that place. He is a prominent member of the Congregational Church and a man of property and standing in society. I will also take him to Lowell and introduce him to those well acquainted with me there and to all of the places where I have visited. If he will take the trouble to go, I will bear his expenses, or I will give him any number of reliable names whom he may address on the matter. The first reactions of both Mary and her family should have been heeded. Perhaps being dissuaded and learning by experience enabled Mrs. Eddy to write in Science and Health, quote, "The first impression made on a mind which is attracted or repelled according to personal merit or demerit is a good detective of individual character," end quote. But Daniel was personable, likable, and persuasive. So before the end of April, he and Mrs. Glover were engaged to be married. In her autobiography, Mrs. Eddy has little more to say than, "My second marriage was very unfortunate. But this unfortunate union continued for 13 long years."